Hello and thank you for tuning in to Foster Care Radio, breaking the silence on foster care in Canada. Hello everyone and thank you for tuning in to the first edition of Foster Care Radio. I'm your host, John Dunn. In today's show, I'm going to interview myself to start with. You might be wondering what I meant when I said I'll be interviewing myself in this show, so I'll explain. With the miracle of computer technology, I'm able to make it sound as if I'm talking to myself on the telephone.
Excuse me, can we get on with this interview? I don't actually have all day.
Sorry, folks, that must have been my alter ego. Anyhow, I'm going to interview myself about my website, the Canadian After Foster Care Council, which is located at www.afterfostercare.com. Hello, John, and welcome to Foster Care Radio.
Thanks for inviting me.
John, can you tell me how you became involved in the child welfare system?
Time, which consisted of my two older sisters, who would have been around 10 or 12 at the time, Linda and Kathy, my older brother Ronnie, who was about 4, and my mother Mary, or as everyone called her, Mickey. My mother was an alcoholic and suffered from severe bipolar disorder, formerly known as manic depression. When I was 18 months old, my mother tried to commit suicide, and from that day forward, I was separated from my sisters, my brother, and my mother, and taken into my first foster home. When I was 4 years old, the Catholic Children's Aid reunited my brother and I, and we moved through a series of foster homes together. Then when I was about 10 years old, I was reunited with my mom and my two sisters, and we all continued to have regular visits after that. When I turned 13, the courts decided that my brother and I could move in with our mother for a 6-month trial. That didn't work out well because we were practically strangers, I guess, and with my brother and I having been abused for years while we were in foster care, we were a bit much for her to handle. And she had an argument with my brother, and somehow the cops were called, and off back into foster care we went. This time, I was put back into foster care alone, and my brother went to another foster home. This was the first time I'd ever been separated from him since our first reunion when I was 4. I was very hurt by the separation from my family, especially from my brother, and I would act out by screaming for no reason, trying not to go to church, and cutting myself, and generally misbehaving. I was shipped off to a group home at 13 for 4 years. Then after the CCAS, the Catholic Children's Aid in Toronto, got wind of the fact that we were being abused in that home, I was shipped through about 4 more homes, and then at 18 I left the system.
You mentioned being separated from your brother when you were 13, and you were extremely hurt by this. When did you see him again?
I don't remember seeing him again for the next 9 years or so until I bumped into him while I was filling out a resume at the same company he worked for.
That's incredible. What happened when you met him?
Well, I was filling out a resume there. I was went into a courier company at 350 Bay Street in Toronto, and as I was sitting in a chair, my brother walked by, and I didn't see him. I just saw his legs when he walked by, and I knew it was him instantly just by looking at his legs, because he always used to flex his legs and tell me to punch his legs as hard as I could because, you know, he was showing off his muscles or whatever. So as soon as I saw his thigh, I knew it was him, and I looked up and I said, "Ron and John," and we hugged each other and we were all, you know, happy in the office there and kind of crying and stuff. And it was pretty weird. You know, it was a really, really good day though to see him again after that long.
Right on. That's cool. When you were telling me you were abused in care, do you mind me asking what things happened to you while you were in care?
No, actually, I don't mind. I actually find it kind of therapeutic to talk about it, and I hope that by talking about it, I can encourage others to come forward with their stories as well. I'll start out by telling you what happened to me while I was between the ages of 6 until 9, while we were in a home that was supposed to adopt us. As far back as I can remember, I was a bedwetter. I would always be dreaming that I was walking through the forest on a nice sunny day, and I'd come up to a tree and proceed to go to the washroom on the tree, but every time I did that, I would wake up with wet sheets and pajamas, and the bed was wet. So the father would always punish me by taking me down into the basement, and they had this wood-burning stove, which was like a barrel on its side, and a door on the end of it, and a chimney up the back. And he used to pick me up and sit me on top of this thing, until I would hear my pajamas sizzle from the heat. as a way to scare me out of it. Then one day he decided to open the door and started to push me in head first into it with all the coals and the flames and everything there. I just remember screaming and trying to stop myself from going in, but it would just burn my hands as I tried to push back. I remember just thinking I was going to die right there in the flames. But he also used to, or at one time he flushed my head down the toilet because I accidentally flooded it with a large bowel movement. That time I thought I was going to drown to death while he held my head in the toilet as it flushed. So, and another time for bedwetting, he knelt down in front of me, put pliers on my penis, and threatened to crush it if I went to bed again. I also had to witness my brother's beatings as well, which was really difficult because I was totally unable to protect him. When I went into the group home at 14, I was subjected to 4 more years of abuse and neglect and witnessing the abuse of the other boys in the home as well.
So after you left foster care, John, what did you do with yourself?
Well, I first moved out of Clifton House, which was a wonderful place near Broadview and Danforth in Toronto. I moved into a 2-bedroom flat with 2 of the boys from the home, and at first, I lived off the $2,500 that I had saved up before leaving Clifton House. And unfortunately, I partied to celebrate my independence and ability to have fun now without worrying about getting into trouble when I got home. But eventually, of course, I spent all of my savings and couldn't pay the rent. I then spent the next 19 years of my life getting jobs, losing apartments, getting other apartments, and being rescued by friends who offered a couch once in a while. Since 1988, I've moved 27 times and had about 60 jobs and went back to school 4 times trying to improve myself.
So tell me, John, why did you create the After Foster Care website?
Well, the website actually started in 1999 when I was working at CBC as a tech repair guy. I was getting tired of always losing jobs, which in turn caused me to lose my apartment, and then I would end up on welfare, and then I'd get another job, and so on, and the vicious cycle continued. I was finally starting to cry out for help at the age of 29 years old. The site was called Get It Together, and it was a way of finding other people who were also having a hard time in life keeping on track, and, well, basically getting it together. At the time, I hadn't made the connection from my life in care to my adult instability. I just figured I was a loser who couldn't take care of myself, you see.
Right.
So I made this site to find others who were in the same boat, so we could start helping each other to get it together, so to speak, by creating a network of, as I called them, distant friends.
What exactly is a distant friend?
A distant friend is someone who you know, but not very well, because when you know someone at first, we're at our best behavior, so to speak, when we're in the getting to know you phase of a relationship. We're naturally trying to give the best impression of ourselves during this phase, and maybe even trying to show off how good or valuable or worthy we are, much like a product. Once you have a product for any amount of time, the novelty wears off. The human-to-human relationship is also like this. Over time, we get comfortable with the person. We drop our guard more and more, and begin to reduce the frequency or the urgency in which we feel we must prove ourselves to the other person, because we know by then that they've already accepted us, so why should we try anymore? So I figure with this network of friends, we could meet weekly and exchange skills, resources, tell each other something that was a goal for themselves, so they would actually have someone to boast to when they completed one of their goals each week.
That sounds like a great idea, John, but why not use your friends or your family for this?
Well, that's the problem and the turning point where this site inspired the After Foster Care site. I thought about this myself, and although it sounds like the natural thing to do for most people, a lot of people who have survived through foster care have been emotionally crushed, neglected, or abused to the point where to ask for help is not only useless, but can result in ridicule or silent body language and signs that say, do it yourself. After years of this, you give up, and even when you're begging for help inside, you can't pass it through your lips for fear of the ensuing ridicule. After years of alienation from your natural family, the last thing you want to be doing as a former foster kid is asking them for help, because that's already in their minds. extended family are a lot of the time wondering why you're contacting them and what you want from them. So this gives even more reason to not ask them for help. I only want to contact them if I'm successful, not if I'm the failure I had become. So when I realized I felt this way, I thought there must be other foster care survivors who are going through the same thing. Hence, the After Foster Care site was born.
In our previous discussions, you made note of the fact that your website went through various different growth stages or focuses. Can you explain those?
Oh, man, for sure. The website essentially has been a window to my soul over the past couple of years. I've gone through quite the metamorphosis, and I'm still actually going through that change from the worthless piece of crap that I thought I was to trying to turn my experience and care into positive changes in the system. In March of 2000, I had an emotional breakdown, and I cried alone in my apartment for about a month. I even wrote 9 poems, which I'd never wrote poems before, ever. I still don't know what happened, but I believe that it was just time for me to begin living for the reason I was put on this planet. What triggered it? Could have been a few things. In October of 1998, my mother, whom I love very much, committed suicide. And I also had quit smoking 3 months before and lost a 4-year relationship with a wonderful girl just 1 month before. I think all of these things contributed to my breakdown to a certain degree, but I feel the reason I had this breakdown is because I had lived my life emotionally turned off. I was like a robot, John the funny guy everyone else thought, but inside I was empty. The breakdown almost destroyed me for once. I understood the pain that causes suicide, a pain I had shut off when I was only 14. The year before that, when I was 13, I had lost my family for the second time, and more importantly, I had lost my brother. When I was 14 in a group home near Picton, I had one last hard cry in the shower so nobody could hear me. I was lying on my side in the tub, a skinny, naked, scared little boy, crying so hard I was paralyzed in like a silent scream while laying on the shower floor with the water pouring over me. I don't remember crying ever again after that until I was in my late 20s. I guess the mind knows how to protect itself by shutting down, eh?
Yeah, you're telling me.
But I still feel it was necessary in order to save me at the time. I had to shut off. But then, 16 years later, it all came rushing back, and I suddenly began to feel again. With those feelings came the mourning of my mother's suicide, the loss of my brother, the repeated losses of all my friends, my favorite hangouts, my schools, my memories, my familiar bedrooms, my teachers, my bus drivers, my pets, my toys, my clothes, my books, my own personal areas, everything. I needed to get connected with my past again somehow, so I started on a quest to obtain copies of my files that the Catholic Children's Aid kept on my life, my brother's life, and that of my mom. So I posted my intentions on the website. When I was refused copies of my files by the Catholic Children's Aid Society in Toronto, this became a bit of a quest. So they also fired one of their workers, Michelle Edmonds, for trying to help me get a summary done on my files when she wasn't a disclosure worker, so they fired her immediately without any compensation. She had to fight with a lawyer to get her compensation, her, termination pay and all that. And that's when I guess I realized how there was something very sinister going on with these records. The agencies militantly protect these files from getting into the hands of the public for more than just simple confidentiality issues. What I feel they're doing is protecting themselves from the mass lawsuits that might ensue when all of these abused children become angry adults who know their rights, and what they're doing is not allowing them to obtain any legally binding documentation which proves that abuse. What they do is they offer a summary of our files when we request them. This summary actually takes more time to type out, but allows them to reword things or leave information out that may be incriminating. Any person who's employed by a foster care agency to do these summaries is either naive and blissfully goes about summarizing people's records, but leaving out information they're told will be harmful to the client needs a wake-up call. They're simply keeping institutionalized child abuse a deep, dark secret. but they are brainwashed into thinking they're protecting the client from emotional harm. They think they're doing good. They really do, John. John, are you there?
I'm still here. Just waiting for you to answer my question.
What was it?
I was inquiring about the different growth stages of your site.
Any disclosure worker who makes summaries of people's files and feels they're doing us a great service is unfortunately brainwashed to the point that they would argue with me till they're blue in the face that they are doing good, that they're trying to protect me. Then there are those who actually know what they're doing and why. They feel such a strong loyalty to the agency that they would defend the process as militantly as those who don't know better. And also, there is the disclosure worker who still has a soul and a mind of their own, who will one day risk their job in order to try to stop this practice of keeping secret over 100 years of institutionalized child abuse. They will feel the years of torture they read in those files, and they will no longer be a part of it. There is already a movement of workers who have deliberately mishandled or misplaced some very important documents on some very high-profile cases. From a former foster kid to those fighting the system from the inside, I thank you from the bottom of my heart and for all of the innocent children who are too young to thank you today.
Are you done with this rant yet, John?
Where was I? The site. The After Foster Care site went from angry at the CCAS disclosure worker, Barb Milan, to being angry at Mary McConville, the executive director, for not giving me my files, and has now turned into a bit more of a professional, but still unaffiliated and totally independent body, which will continue to allow people to talk freely about foster care issues. It is a tool that will empower the people who are victimized by overzealous policies to speak out and to help change the policies and the mindsets of those who have been long ago burned out in the system or closed themselves off from human emotions in order to cope with the policies they must abide by in order to keep their jobs. There is a message board at the website as well, where anyone from social workers to foster parents to birth parents, foster kids, or any Canadian who wishes to discuss foster care or adoption in Canada can come to socialize. There's also a news center, which operates much like an indie media website, where every Canadian can submit articles, poetry, press releases, news events related to foster care in Canada. It's their chance to become a journalist. You can find foster care-related poetry, read John's summaries of his therapy sessions, and, of course, listen online to Foster Care Radio by going to afterfostercare.com.
That's excellent, John. It sounds like you've dedicated a lot of time and tears to this site, and I wish you the very best of luck with its progress.
Thank you.
Thank you.